God for sending your son to die so that I don't have to. So those are great words of thanks. And there's something about that that just makes our hearts a little bit bigger when we thank God. So this morning, that title, Believe in the Amazingness. That's a word, by the way, amazingness. You'll find it in the Bible. I'm going to just read it right here. And we'll look for where it shows up in this next story that we have from the book of John. And we're going through the book of John in chapter 2. And it says, the next day, there was a wedding celebration in the village of Cana in Galilee. And Jesus' mother was there. And Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the celebration. The wine supply ran out during the festivities. So Jesus' mother told him, they have no more wine. Dear woman, that's not our problem, Jesus replied. My time has not yet come. But his mother told the servants, do whatever he tells you. Standing nearby were six stone water jars used for Jewish ceremonial washing. Each could hold 20 to 30 gallons. And Jesus told the servants, fill the jars with water. When the jars had been filled, he said, now dip some out and take it to the MC, the master of ceremonies. So the servants followed his instructions. When the master of ceremonies tasted the water that was now wine, not knowing where it had come from, though of course the servants knew, he called the bridegroom over. He said, a host always serves the best wine first, he said. But when everyone has had a lot to drink, he brings out the less expensive wine. But you have kept the best until now. And then it says, this miraculous sign at Cana in Galilee was the first time Jesus revealed his glory. And his disciples believed in him. Did you catch the word amazingness in there? Well, my translation, instead of glory, it says amazingness. They caught a glimpse of his amazingness. There was this sense that for a moment, people just got a little bit more of a picture into heaven, a little bit more of a picture of what God is like. And this was his first sign that just kind of opened up just a little bit. You know, we oftentimes, many of us have read the Bible. We see how it all kind of unfolds. But for these disciples, they're just walking down a journey. Last week, Peter talked to us about them just saying, yep, coming, going with you kind of thing. And Jesus had five disciples now. And Nathanael had noticed, had said, you saw me under the fig tree? That was one of the disciples? I'm amazed. Okay, I'll follow you. And Jesus said, you're going to see greater things than that. And here we have 3 days later. Here's Jesus. Here's the disciples. Here's his family. His mom is there. And they're at Cana, which is just like 4 miles from Nazareth. So it's like local. It's real close. And they would have known a lot of people, would have been really familiar. And it says that when the disciples saw this amazingness sign, they believed. Gospel John is all about belief. It's about, will you believe in what you see, in what you experience, in what you touch, in what you know? And it says the disciples did that. So we get the sneak preview into what God's like, and the disciples are there. Now, it doesn't say a lot about the rest of the folks there, but it definitely says that the disciples started to see it. They started to get it. And I hope this morning, I guess where I want to go in this talk is that we would just get it a little bit more. That in some ways, our belief would move from here to here. And belief isn't a wooden thing. It isn't something that you just either believe utterly or you don't believe utterly. It's like something that's moving. And this morning, we want to look at this and say, what is there in this story that we can learn? Now, the context, the situation is, it's a wedding. And I just was talking to people and about being at a wedding yesterday. And you know, we go to weddings, and they're great events. And if you know the person well and it's close, it's like, oh, I want this to be a great day for that couple, don't we? Like, there's just so much goodwill flowing at a wedding. And back in the Middle Eastern weddings back then, it was like a 7-day-long event. Can you imagine you just stop your life for 7 days? We don't do that. Like, we get maybe a bonus day at Thanksgiving, and it's like one long weekend. But our lives move pretty quick. Back then, it was relational. You know, they weren't as much a production society. They were a relational society. It makes all the difference. And so they just stop, and they just work, you know, relate. They'd hang out. They'd eat. Can you imagine, like, Thanksgiving, they go for 7 days? I've got 2 dinners tomorrow. One at my wife's, I've got to pace myself in 1 day tomorrow, which is going to be really hard for me to do. But these people had to pace it out for 7 days. So the deal about it was having something to drink. And back then, a lot of it wasn't healthy. You've got to understand the context, too, on the wine deal. Some people think that Jesus was just such a party animal. He was just trying to get everybody wasted. It wasn't that at all. Clearly, the Bible says, don't get drunk with wine. There's some clear guidelines about that. Some people take the other approach and they say, you know what, never going to touch it kind of thing. And there's no question that in our society today, and I'm sure there was back then too, there are issues about alcoholism and some of the abuses of it. And one really needs to deal with great wisdom and discernment. But Jesus was all about celebrations. He was all about parties. And he was here saying, you know what, I'm going to take 5 jars, big stone jars. You think about them, 20 to 30 gallons, that's like big, okay? And 6 of them makes about 150 gallons of water that he turned into wine. You can imagine this, like this bland, common water. And all of a sudden you've got, I think probably red wine. How many of you think red wine? Probably red wine, yeah. He made it into red wine. And so it's changed color, everything about it changes. That would have made 2,400, half a pint to a glass of wine. That would have been 2,400 servings of wine. So that was a lot of wine. And so here's Jesus saying, you know what? I want this relational setting. I want these relationships to keep going. And the reality was that if they ran out of something to drink, okay, and it's a hot climate, people would just go home. It would have been over, like done. There would have been embarrassment for the family. It would have been a major social faux pas back then. There could have been shame. You know, it's like, oh, they're the guys who, yeah, they didn't, you know, and the wedding just kind of crashed. And so Jesus is seeing this, and she jumps in on the situation. We don't know. Maybe Jesus was connected enough, Mary, Jesus' mother, was connected enough to the family that she was part of the hosting committee. It may have been that she came up to him and said, Jesus, we don't have any more wine. Hint, hint. It's time to show your amazingness. Like, maybe it's the common thing. You know, moms, Suzanne mentioned we were watching our daughter play. We just want our kids to succeed, right? Like, yeah, that's part of me there. And Jesus, can you imagine being the mother of Jesus? Like, she knows there's this latent power in there, this amazingness, that if he would just kind of express it, like, this would be big. She could be, you know... I don't know all the motivation. It doesn't really tell us in here. But regardless, it's an interesting response that Jesus said. You know, this translation kind of softens it. In other translations, it says, you know, woman, that's not my problem kind of thing. It can come off that way. But in fact, it's like more of a context like my lady. And it's like there's this common, you know, Jewish expression, I guess Hebrew expression. What is that to you and to me? It's kind of the direct translation on that. And he says, my time has not yet come. It's an interesting response to a pretty innocent comment that she made. But there's something to this. And I think there's something amazingness in this, even in this interaction between Jesus and his mom. What it does tell us is that God is all about doing things the way he's going to do them. And in the time that he's going to do them. There's a word for that. It's called sovereignness of God. Now, there's both God's sovereignty and there's his identification with people. What we have here is Jesus had come out of a situation we talked about a couple of weeks ago where he had said, I'm one of you. I'm going to get baptized. We talked about his baptism down in Jordan. He goes into this muddy river and gets baptized just like everybody else. But in this comment, in his response, he's saying, you know, I'm one of you, but I'm absolutely separate and alone in my mission here on earth. He's saying, you know what? I am not going to be swayed by the persuasion of people or by the crowds. And my time is going to be my time. And I'm going to do all of this not with your very best interests in mind. It's going to be all about love. And my ultimate expression of love is going to come when I give my life for you on the cross. Again and again throughout the gospel, we see Jesus refer to his hour or to his time. And what he's saying is, I'm going to call the shots. He wasn't a victim here when it came to going to the cross. When I know that it's the right time, I'm going to do it. So there's that part of that time thing. And then there's also this relationship between Jesus where he's really identifying, saying, I know that you have good intentions. I know that you want the best. And I think God looks at our hearts and he looks at our minds too. And he knows. He knew what was going on in Mary's heart and mine. And he says, I believe that you want the best. But you know what? My best might be a little bit different than yours, and it might be at a different time, too. And that's part of the coming to Christ and becoming a disciple of Christ, is saying, you know, ultimately, I trust you, God. What you know and what you're going to do is in your best, is in my best interest. And the whims and the wishes of everybody is not going to sway God in terms of where he is going to go and what he's going to do. You know, we have, on a human level, we have this incredible propensity to want to please others. We have oftentimes addiction approval, you know, approval addiction, where we want to somehow, you know, do what the other people want, or maybe even what the biggest group wants, right? And it may not be the best. I found it very interesting. I was reading Sports Illustrated a few months ago. I'm kind of addicted to that magazine. But it had a really interesting article in there about why the home team wins. You know, in sports, they found that when they did thousands of, there's guys that do statistics on everything, right? And they looked at all the documented professional five, the big five sports, right? Hockey, baseball, basketball, soccer, and football. Football, and they went through thousands of games, and they said, why is it at the end of the day, as we look at this, we look at all the results of all these games in the five major professional sports, 60% of the time, the home team wins. And they were able to document it. Sometimes, in some sports, it's like high 50s, and in some sports, like basketball, it's more high 60s, but it's right in that range for every sport. The home team wins. And I think, you know, even in your mind, you're going, oh, I know why it is. And they said, you know, it might not be what you think it is. It's not, and they went through the myths. It's not because the home crowd boosts players' performances. There might be some element of that, but they revealed that as a myth. They said it's not because of the travel, you know, the visitors are, and they had some statistical analysis to say, it's not really about that. It's not because the home team has a, you know, kinder, gentler kind of schedule. And it's not because of the unique home characteristics, you know, of whatever, you know, your own field, that sort of thing. It's, you know, actually they're quite standard. They came to the conclusion that the real reason for the home team advantage, after analyzing thousands of score sheets from five sports, the home team consistently receives more and better calls from the refs. The refs are professionals, right? They're supposed to be unbiased. But at the end of the day, they say there's something internal that even happens in these refs, as unbiased as they try to be. The pressure of the crowd, everybody yelling and screaming at them, causes them to make biased calls in favor of the home team. They said that, then they had a bunch of statistics as to how they, and in fact, they said the place where it shows up maybe even the most is in soccer, predominantly in Europe, where the crowd, and we're talking big and loud crowds, are right on top of them, of the refs. And they can make discretionary call about how much injury time they give. And the injury time is always longer if the home team is behind than it is if, you know. But interesting enough, they said actually if there's, in some leagues, there's a running track around the field which separates the crowd a little bit more from the refs, and they could statistically prove that the refs are less influenced when the crowd's a little bit further away from them as well. So it's kind of an interesting, but what it says, my point is, we get influenced. We think we don't, we aren't, we think, okay, I'm, but Jesus was not. He was a leader in every way. It's nice to know that God will make the best call, the right call. We can trust him for that. And it's not going to just go on the whim of some people and what they think at the time. There's an incredible amount of that, and it gives us a glimpse into the divinity of Jesus, that he was God, that he was going to do things in the right way and in the right time. God always knows what's best. He isn't swayed by some special relationship, even a mother or son, or affected by the polls. Nobody's going to twist his arm into anything. He's a leader in every sense, and that makes his character great. That makes him a God that we can trust. If we know that his character is about love, if we know that it's about perfection, then we can trust that. That's an incredible insight into his amazingness. The other thing I love about this is that Jesus shows his amazingness on the down low. It's like it's not really like big splash kind of thing. I mean, it turns out to be a pretty big splash in water, wine, but it wasn't something that he would trumpet. And oftentimes when he'd heal people, he'd say, don't tell anybody. I love that it's like, a little bit, you know, there's some restraint. There's some understatement in how God works. And he really requires, or he looks to people to, it takes us being willing to notice, to kind of look for it. And I guess a little bit like Thanksgiving, sometimes when we stop, we go, oh yeah, I do have all of these things to be thankful for. And in the same way, faith works that way. Belief works that way. When we stop and we go, oh yeah, God did do that amazing thing there. Or he did that amazing sign there. Or he's doing this amazing thing in my life right now. And it takes us looking for it, because sometimes we could miss it otherwise. Belief requires the eyes to see it, to be able to recognize it, to see that God is doing amazing things. He is the Alpha and Omega. He spoke the world into being. And in that situation, to turn, you know, 130 gallons of water into wine, small thing for God. God does amazing things if we're looking for it, if we look through the eyes of faith in our lives. And you might know, you might kind of look at yourself personally, or maybe there's somebody that you know and you say, you know what, even if a sign happened, like something huge right in front of them, would they notice it? Would they acknowledge it? Would they believe it? God wants us to open up our minds and our hearts and say, I'm willing, God. I'm willing. I'm going to look and I'm going to be open. And when you're doing something amazing, this MC, he could have missed it. Had it not been for the servants, you know, it was all the servants doing the work behind the scenes. And he comes up to the host, he goes, this is amazing. It was only when he was informed that, okay, this is what happened. Jesus turned the water into wine. Something very cool about that. I think there's another thing that I find amazing about this whole situation is that Jesus took the water, and it wasn't just any water. He actually took water that was poured into these ceremonial pots. Now, we don't have anything the equivalent in our homes today, really. Back then, there was all sorts of Jewish laws that were about ceremonial cleansing. And sometimes if you look through the Old Testament, you'll start reading through these books and there's laws on everything. And when we really look at it, it was often many of those laws were laws that were about cleanliness, about keeping bacteria from being transferred. They didn't have all the scientific evidence that we have today and, you know, knowledge that way. So the ceremonial water washing was something that was both kind of a ritual, and there was a spiritual kind of significance, but it was also kind of a purely, you know, sanitation kind of thing. But they would actually wash their hands ceremonially between every course of the meal. And there was this incredible, well, what happened was the religious leaders kind of got onto this, and they took every little thing and got in the law, in the Leviticus, and they used it to oppress the people. They used it to kind of beat them down, to help to shame them, really. To put shame on them. Like, you're not doing this quite right. We're doing it right. And they were really the only people who had enough time in the day to make it happen, right? And so these people just felt oppressed by this whole system. And it became all about following laws, following rules. And relationships were damaged because of it. And sometimes religious systems can really, really be damaging to relationships. And here's what Jesus is saying, that ultimately His heart is for relationships to succeed, to do well, for grace and to love, to pour, to flow between people. And so he took this thing that represented oppression and rules, and he made it about relationships. He turned the water from these ceremonial pots into wine. I think there's something very significant about that. Here was Jesus communicating to people, you know, what matters to me is relationship, primarily the relationship between us and God. And how that affects our relationship with others. And it's about love and about grace flowing. He didn't just take one stone pot, he took all of them. I think the part of that was God wanted us to communicate to us, there's this incredible abundance of grace. It's like too much. It's like more than you'd even get through. It's like there's this grace that just wants to flow into your lives. And I think if we get that part of our relationship with God, it changes everything. I just take for instance, the kind of the rule around marriage and about wedding and about sexual intimacy. And I think oftentimes people look at things and go, you know, why is it that there's this rule about doing a wedding ceremony or, you know, declaring your commitment to each other? And people kind of get fixated on that and saying, you know, the religious people, they're all kind of hung up on that. Why can't we just go down this road together and then, you know, figure this out? And why is it even necessary? I think that's a common thing today because people are going, I don't want to be bound by the rules. But you know, it's interesting. When one looks at it and says, what we want in a marriage, in a relationship, is trust, is commitment. And that sexual intimacy is something that comes out of that kind of commitment to each other. It helps us to understand when that becomes the dominant thing. We go, okay, I get the rule, so to speak, or I get why we want to commit and then go down that path. You know, I was just reading a review in a book that again, statistically showed that relationships that are about commitment and then towards intimacy and cohabitating after, and you may be very familiar with that too. Statistically, they do much better. They end up lasting longer and breaking apart less often when a person puts commitment and the relational commitment first. I found it interesting that the study showed that, in fact, what also comes out of in their findings is that couples who make the commitment first, get married, rather than just cohabitating, often are much better at conflict resolution. They know their kind of fights, and we all have fights. They fight fairer, and they fight with much more of a sense of we can resolve this together. And it makes sense when you realize that, you know, if you're kind of in a relationship and you're not sure where it's going to go and it might threaten the relationship, it says you actually end up having much more kind of backdoor conflict or stuff that just is kind of toxic that happens in a relationship than when you know, okay, we're committed to each other, we're going to work this out, and it becomes much more upfront and more positive and able to be resolved much better in those conflictive relationships. I found that interesting. Again and again, when you look at what God has that appear to us as being constrictive rules, they're really there because he wants relationships to flourish. He wants love to be communicated. He wants grace to flow between people. And in this situation, that's what Jesus was doing with this ceremonial washing pot kind of cleansing kind of situation. Fourth thing about God that's just amazingness is that, again, it's God just showing to these people that he cares about every need that we have. You know, it might seem like a small thing. Here's Jesus saying, you know, here's a wedding. I want to keep that going. You know, and there were some pretty big stuff. You know, somebody who's dying and God, or even raises back to life. But here's God just saying, you know what? I care about this. And I think sometimes we're maybe hesitant or we don't think that God notices the things that are deep to us or that matter to us. And we can kind of gloss over them or somehow think that, you know, God's just about the big stuff. But he really does care about everything. He cares about every need that we have. God has the power to meet that need. So whatever we need from God, if it's joy, he wants to meet that need for more joy. Is it contentment? Is it someone close to you that they would come to experience and enjoy a relationship with Jesus? Whatever it is the need that we feel we have, God cares about it. And he wants to meet that. Is it power over temptation? Is it the need for perseverance right now? Whatever it is that we need, God says, I'm there. And I'm there to give it in like abundance, more than you would even need. Is it hope? I heard somebody say recently, you can go 4 months without food. You can go 4 days without water. You can go 4 minutes without air. But you can't go 4 seconds without hope. We all need hope. What is it that we need poured into our lives right now? God says, you know what? I've got enough for that. I can meet that need. And fifth and finally, what God touches, he changes. Whatever it is that he comes in contact with, he says, I'm able to change that. And in our lives, he says, when you believe. There's an interesting concept. When it comes to water, God can just turn it into wine just like that. When it comes to kind of our free will and how God interacts with us, it's when we believe, God changes it. And the challenge to us, what comes out of this incredible sign, this amazingness here, is that God's saying, would you believe that? If you believe it, you'll receive it. If you believe it, you'll receive it. God wants to touch our lives, and when he touches our lives, he changes our lives. God says, you know what, I want to come in, and I want to take what might be bland and common in your life, like the water was, and I want to turn it into something that's great. That's vital and alive. And I think so oftentimes we think there's another way to get there. But I love Matthew chapter 6, verse 33. It says, seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. So it's like God saying, you know, if you will come to me and believe, if you'll come to me and believe that what you're looking for, hope, joy, contentment, peace, whatever it is in your life, if you come to me and believe, I can give that to you. If you chase after these things, success, significance, security, you chase after that and you make that the thing, you don't find yourself experiencing it. But you chase after God and you believe in God, and I love how one friend of mine puts it. He says, those things kind of sneak up behind you and smack you on the back of the head. You go, oh, I'm experiencing that now. But it's because I'm believing in Jesus. I'm going down that path. I think that's what this sign is inviting us to. The closing comment on this passage is the disciples believed. And as they went down that path, they experienced more and more of the life that Jesus had for them. I love John chapter 10, verse 10. And it's a bit of a theme verse for Coast Hills, I guess, ever since this church was started, was that Jesus says, I have come that you might have life and have it to the full. I love the idea of life. And one of our taglines is giving life to living. That God's here actually to make just, it's more than just surviving life. It's more than just kind of making it to the next day. It's like, I want to give you life. And I see in this sign, in this miracle that Jesus said, he's bringing life into a party. It's fun that it's a joyous, celebrative kind of context that Jesus chose to do his first miracle in. I think that's pretty significant about the heart and the belief of God. He says, I really want you to experience life and to really live it like a wedding feast would be. And there's going to be shortcomings in this life, and there's going to be disappointment, and there's going to be all those things. That's just the nature of living. But one day you're going to experience that forever. That's eternity for you. And so he says, would you believe and receive it? I have an overabundance of grace to give you. I want to just kind of take it. I love the thought of just thinking, here's God. He's got what it is that we need. He knows what we need. And he cares about it. And he wants to just pour it into our lives. It's pretty cool when you think about it. God, you just want to pour it. Maybe even if you're having Thanksgiving or you're sitting down for lunch afterwards, you just think, okay, just like I'm pouring something in a glass. God wants to take this thing, and he has the power to. And he wants to just pour it into my life. If I just ask, he says, come and believe, and he'll give it to us. I want to close in prayer. I invite you to stand, and we'll close. God, I just want to thank you that as you showed in this miracle, you delight in a joyous, celebrative kind of a life. You truly want to give life to living. I thank you for holidays like we have this weekend where I hope we can experience that in some way or another, whatever our context might be, that we just experience that kind of life, that we would maybe bring it to the table for somebody else, whatever it is that we're experiencing this weekend. I thank you that if we need help or we need companionship, you're there to pour it into our lives. If we need joy, you're there to pour it into our lives. If we need contentment, if we even need more of a thankful spirit, you're there to pour it into our lives. If we need hope, I thank you that when we ask you, when we believe, when we make that first, then the rest follows. And I just pray that each person here would experience that today and this week, that in our context, whatever our situation is, we would go ahead with the belief that just like in that miracle, you can do a miracle in our lives and in the lives of those around us. I thank you for that, God. In your name, amen. Well, I hope you have a wonderful day, and whether you get Monday off or not, I hope you've had some chance to relax and refresh and renew this weekend. And look forward to seeing you again next Sunday. My wife and I are going to be away, but Peter's going to be here leading the service as well. So have a great afternoon.